Welcome back to Dakota Midday. I'm Lori Walsh. In 2011, people took to the streets in waves of protest and solidarity in Arab countries such as Tunisia. Since those early days of hope and revolution, the world has seen the collapse of the Arab region, civil wars, failed states, bloody repression, and a humanitarian crisis of horrific magnitude. Mark Lynch is a professor of political science at George Washington University. He's an Andrew Carnegie Fellow and the author of the new book, The New Arab Wars, Uprisings, and Anarchy in the Middle East. Mark Lynch is in Brookings tonight for a lecture at the South Dakota World Affairs Council. He will also present at the Festival of Books this weekend. I caught up with Lynch to talk about the book, about American policy, about oppression, and about why Arab youth no longer believe in the hope of democracy. We started with his 2012 book about the Arab uprising and how to bridge the gap between the Arab Spring and what's happening today in Syria and beyond.
Well, basically, the Arab uprisings that broke out in early 2011, they really offered hope for positive change in the Arab world for pretty much the first time in anybody's living memory. I think the last time I remember there being any kind of optimism like that was maybe the Oslo Accords back in 1993 between Israel and the Palestinians. Mm-hmm. And so there was just an enormous amount of just enthusiasm and hope back in 2011. And we got so excited about it that I think many people lost sight of how difficult it was going to be to change things over there. And so the last book tried to lay out both how exciting and how novel everything was, while also issuing some warnings about just how entrenched a lot of the problems of the region really were. And so this book picks up where that one left off and really goes into exactly how the uprisings failed and really puts a lot of weight on how the regimes and states of the region worked to prevent there being any real change, because they basically saw that as against their own interests.
Where did the hope come from? What was sort of driving that?
Well, you know, there's just been an enormous amount of pent-up frustration in the region for many years, for decades, and nobody really thought that change was possible. And so back in January 2011, you suddenly had this uprising in Tunisia, which actually overthrew a president who had been in power for 30 years. And then a few weeks later, you have another uprising that overthrows the president of Egypt, who had been in power for 30 years. And these were the sorts of things that most people just didn't believe was possible. And so that really inspired people everywhere in the region. So you had people rising up in almost every country in the region trying to change things. And that level of just excitement and enthusiasm is something which most of us never expected to see.
And you said that the uprisings failed. Did they fail?
Yeah, I think you can only say that they failed. The only country which has really succeeded in its transition is Tunisia, which has been very fortunate. But in Egypt, the uprising ended in a military coup, which restored the old regime to power. Syria, Libya, Yemen are now in incredibly bloody and horrible civil wars. And in most every other country, the old regimes survived and have become more repressive, more violent. And it's hard to really find any place in the region anymore that that has anything left of that hope from 2011.
So when I say, did they fail, I guess what I'm wondering is that a complete failure? Is there any hope left from that? Or is that something that we're going to look back on 20 years from now and say was just simply a blip and it really doesn't exist anymore? It certainly doesn't seem to exist now, but take us forward a little bit.
No, I agree that there actually is still quite a bit of hope over the long term, because what we have now is this incredibly competent and impressive generation of Arab youth who, you know, they went through these battles and they lost the battles, but they learned from them. And it's still an incredibly young population. They're deeply familiar with modern internet and communications technology, and they've actually experienced success. They know that winning is actually possible. And so at the same time, the conditions in the region just get worse and worse economically, politically, and everything else. And so I think what you're likely to see, maybe not tomorrow, maybe not next week, but over the next couple of years, I think you're likely to see another wave of that kind of mobilization and protest, just simply because you have so many empowered young people and so many problems, and the government's just are unable or unwilling to address all of those problems.
The governments that survived the uprising, how did they survive it? How did they respond to it?
Some of them survived by spending a lot of money. I mean, the oil-rich countries of the Gulf were able to spend a lot of money to buy off domestic uprisings or, people who are dissatisfied. Others used force, the forcible repression, throwing a lot of people in prison, violent, dispersal of people who took to the streets, torture, that sort of thing. And then others, like Jordan and Morocco, they did a pretty effective job of offering limited political reforms, dividing the opposition, holding elections that didn't really change anything, but it was enough to kind of take away the momentum. And so there were different strategies in the different countries, but they all had the common effect of keeping the existing leaders in power and preventing any meaningful political change. Mm-hmm.
You said that Arab leaders never voluntarily surrender power. Do you want to elaborate on that at all?
This has been a constant of modern Arab political history, is that leaders don't leave power voluntarily. They come to identify the state with themselves. And so it's not the kind of situation like the United States, where you know that there's going to be elections and in 8 years the current president will be gone and the institutions of American democracy will continue. And in almost all of these countries, the leaders are essentially identified with the state itself, and they make it impossible for the system to exist without them. And for decades, there was just unbelievable continuity. You either had, between, like, say, 1970 and 2010, like a 40-year period, you had in almost every country in the Middle East, you either had the same person ruling it or the designated successor of that person, the vice president or the king's son, the designated heir. And it just meant that the system was totally identified with the individual. And generally, they knew that if they lost power, they were going to die, that there might be a violent coup, they might be killed. But there was absolutely no tradition of a leader stepping down and then becoming an ex-president or a former king. And so that's why the idea of being able to rise up and peacefully remove a Hosni Mubarak from Egypt was just so revolutionary and so inspiring.
Are there still people, young people, for example, who believe democracy can work in this region?
Well, this is actually one of the huge problems, is that there's actually a lot less belief that democracy can solve problems. So there's still an enormous desire to change things and a great deal of opposition and protest. But I think the allure of democracy has really gone away. The military coup in Egypt was really a shattering blow to the idea that democratic participation could lead to meaningful change. And even in Tunisia, where the elections have been held and the democratic transition has succeeded, there's a widespread feeling that democracy hasn't led to any of the economic problems being solved. There's growing frustration with the politicians as being out of touch and corrupt. And in a sense, there's very much this sense of democracy losing the appeal that it had just 5 years ago.
We're certainly all watching Syria because of the massive numbers of refugees who are fleeing. Is Syria sort of central to all of this? Or are there other things feeding into what's happening in Syria that we're not paying attention to at this time because we're so focused on refugees coming from Syria?
Syria really is the epicenter of a lot of the problems which have emerged. I mean, it really is one of the great humanitarian and political tragedies of the modern era. And there have been, you know, nearly 500,000 dead, more than 10 million refugees. I mean, this is really a devastating thing. And it's resonated across the entire region. People in the region, they identify very, very strongly with the Syrian struggle on one side or the other. It's not like everybody supports either the regime or the opposition, but people are deeply divided, and it's brought out a lot of the worst pathologies in the regional politics, a lot of sectarianism, extremism, and also a lot of just real anger and despair. I mean, people see these they see communities being demolished, they see people being slaughtered, and they can identify with them. They can very easily imagine that being their own communities. And so I think across the region, Syria has become the touchstone for a lot of the pain of the failure of the uprisings.
So is there hope for Syria that as a nation they can recover from this? Where does that hope lie?
It's very hard to have any hope for Syria, I'm afraid. You know, across the region as a whole, I can put some hope in this new generation of young people and their creativity and enthusiasm. But in Syria, I mean, it's just an absolutely devastated country, and it's very difficult to imagine it coming back together anytime in the future. The levels of hatred and the memory of extreme violence is going to make it very difficult for communities to coexist in the future. And, you know, the infrastructure, the economy, the educational system, everything's just been completely pulverized by the war. And so it's going to be a very, very long time before Syria can be put back together. In my view, the best that can be hoped for now is to just try and reduce the fighting, reduce the killing, try and deal with the consequences, help the displaced and do humanitarian work. But I think it's pretty much impossible to actually resolve the conflict at this point. It's almost impossible to either negotiate a final end to the war or for one side to win over the other. So unfortunately, the war is likely to continue for quite some time, and there's very little the United States can do to change that.
Can you compare that to anything else? Is this unprecedented?
It's one of the most complicated and difficult wars in recent history. I mean, the closest comparison would be something like the Congo in Central Africa, but that was not right there at the center of kind of the geostrategically important parts of the Middle East. But right now you have more than half a dozen countries actively involved in either fighting the war or supporting local groups in the war. You have the Islamic State, which is spanning the Syrian and Iraqi border. You've got Russia and the United States directly involved. And then you have this enormously complex mosaic of ethnic and religious groups, along with all kinds of other kinds of groups fighting on the ground. So it's just an incredibly complicated war, and it's you can find some things that are similar to the former Yugoslavia. You can find things that are similar to the Congo, but really it's unique, I think, in the complexity of the war, the number of outside actors that are involved in the fighting, and then the effects that it's having beyond its borders in terms of the refugees.
This is kind of a big question, so you can help me narrow it down appropriately, please. But I'm wondering where the United States has gotten our policy right in the Middle East in recent years, and where have we had missteps?
Well, I mean, I think that the Obama administration, I think, was right in identifying a couple of really big things that had to be done after the disasters of the previous administration. And so getting out of Iraq was a really important thing to kind of put an end to to what had a very real risk of being a permanent occupation of Iraq. And so, you know, getting out of Iraq was a really important step. And getting the nuclear agreement with Iran, I know it's not very popular, but this was a major strategic accomplishment. And there was a very real risk that the conflict over Iran's nuclear program could have led to a war, which would have made Iraq look easy in comparison. And so, you know, by averting a war with Iran and getting out of Iraq, that was a pretty major accomplishment. I think that the downside of the last 8 years or so has been that, you know, the United States has really not been able to navigate effectively the Arab Spring and all the complexities of that, because it faces just this really profound problem, which is that most Americans, and I think many people in the Obama administration, they generally would agree with the idea that you want to see democratic change in the region and you want to support these popular movements. But at the same time, our major allies in the region are precisely the governments that are being challenged. And so we've really had a very difficult time bridging our values, our commitment to democracy, with the hard strategic realities that we're allied with some of the worst dictators and autocrats in the region. And that's just introduced an enormous amount of turbulence and tension. Mm-hmm. And I think it's really also exposed the limits of American influence in the region. You know, we had many ideas for how we would like to see Syria go, but we couldn't make it happen. We couldn't convince the Egyptian military to not step in and overthrow an elected government. And, you know, you can go down the list. We've just really seen, I think, the limitations of America's power and influence in the region.
So knowing the limitations that we have a little bit better than maybe we did even a few years ago, what's our role then? Where do we sort of base our policy looking forward?
It's a great question, and I think that that's probably a debate that we're gonna see unfold over the next few months. I think that there are many people, certainly here in Washington, who are very nostalgic for the idea for a Middle East which is led by the United States, where the U.S. is the center of everything, and we have a fairly stable regional order. And I don't think we're ever going back to that. I think the desire to go back to that is understandable, because it seemed like something which was very conducive to American interests. But the realities are that we're in for an extended period of turbulence, mostly being driven by events inside the region, and ever less interest on the part of the regional powers in kind of subordinating themselves to the United States. They're kind of, the regional powers are going their own way on foreign policy, and there's very little the U.S. can do to persuade them otherwise. And so I think, you know, depending on who wins the presidential election, you might see things going a little bit in one direction or the other in terms of how much military intervention we have and what kinds of issues we tend to prioritize. But I think overall the trend is going to continue to be towards a lower level of American direct involvement in the region and a growing distance between the United States and its long-term allies. Because I think the structural forces there really are pushing it in that direction, and it's going to be very difficult for any president to reverse it.